The meeting was quite interesting. It gathered about 150 to 200 people who are engaged in the work of communications in Australia. And obviously communications in Australia is very different to communications here. The size, the scale that people are dealing with means that they, I think, in many ways have been very quick to see the potential of new media to reach people who are physically quite isolated and to grasp both its potential as a way of sharing information, but maybe more particularly of creating a sense of belonging and a sense of community. And this group of people, who are mainly professionals working in various dimensions of the church's communications ministry, seem to be excited by the challenges of new media, rather than sometimes you experience people who are a little frightened or nervous or challenged. There was actually excitement around about the potential. Their conference focused on the theme was communicating the word, timeless messages, new media. How new media have changed not so much the technologies of communication, but the very culture of communication, the way, the patterns, the dynamics of communications are changing. And we need to think as a church how we position ourselves to best share our message, to establish our relationships in that new media environment.
Talking about the challenges, particularly the challenges perhaps of superficiality, that's one key concern, isn't it?
Yeah. What was interesting about this Congress was they had a number of people who were actually quite critical of new media and suggesting that new media in its own way may be dumbing down public discourse. And there was a lot of good intervention about that. And one point I think we were trying to make, and various speakers were trying to make, was that, look, yes, at a certain level, new media, or certainly some of the new media platforms, require that you are a type of brevity. If you think of Twitter, it, of its nature, requires brevity. Other kind of things, if you're thinking of people who are browsing through internet sites or looking at YouTube, they're moving through quickly. So you need a type of language that can be quite impactful, that can be quite emotive, that can grasp people's attention. And people would obviously have the concern that that type of language is too superficial to do justice to the truths of our faith and of our beliefs.
If we look at new media also, we're talking about moving away from just text form, aren't we, into this very interactive medium.
Yeah, I mean, that was the key points we were making. We were saying one thing is, look, we need that new language, that language that is more impactful, that is briefer, that captures people's attentions. But it's not the only language. It's the entry-level language. People who engage with faith, who engage with theology, who engage with church, will then need to learn a more kind of the language of our tradition. But I suppose for the church, one of the two things that are emerging with the new culture that we want to pick up on very strongly, one is the traditional model we have of media is that the speaker is active, the audience is passive. So I'm here talking into a microphone and everybody else is sitting back attentively listening to me. That's not the reality of it. Maybe it was never the reality, but it's certainly not the reality today. Today people are listening, and if they like what you're saying, they're sharing it, or they're commenting on it, or they want to ask you questions about it. But they're looking for more interactive and a dynamic pattern of communication. The advantage for the church in this is that we now can, through the internet and through various platforms associated with the digital media, we can put out our own messages. We're less dependent on the editors of the big media organizations that we once depended on. However, the downside of that is ours is one line of information. It's one line of communication between so many others. What we're trying to understand is how, as a church, we can take the enthusiasm and the engagement of people who are involved in the church, who are involved also in new media, to allow them to become maybe multipliers of good content, or people who hand on, who pass on messages that they find valuable and worthwhile. So one of the things is to find a way of expressing ourselves that people will find attractive, say, yeah, I can use this, I can perfect this, I can share it with others, and that then we get a kind of diffusion of our teaching in a way that reflects the network society, where it's not top-down, it's put into the mix, and you hope that people will pick up on it and share it. So the challenge is, yes, at times to capture the attention, the language can look a little bit superficial, a little bit gimmicky, but we're saying that's in order to engage persons' attention to then bring them to something richer.
Another of the challenges you're looking at is the question of polarization, that on this new medium, you only look at what interests you and speak to people who think like you.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a real risk here. One risk is, philosophically, we live in a society that is marked by a type of relativism. where some people propose that there's no right or wrong answers. Therefore, there's no point in debate and argument because ultimately everybody's opinion is equally valid. And that's the philosophical position. Add to that the reality that in the internet environment, de facto, you have everything, all sorts of theories being offered. The risk is that somebody, without even engaging philosophically, will almost just resign themselves to a type of relativism and say, look, there's so many different answers there. I could never work out which are the better ones. I'll just go with the ones that I like or the ones that suit me. And the danger is you get people caught in their own little niche and they're not engaging with each other. And that, I think, is particularly true in social media, because in social media, I'm depending on my friends to guide me to the right answers rather than necessarily through an engagement with the content itself. So the risk is that we get groups of like-minded people sharing materials that reaffirm them in their views without necessarily opening up a bigger and more positive debate. I mean, at one level, it's great. It means we can share worthwhile material of faith, give them to our own believers who will take them from us and trusting them, knowing that they're coming from us, and we'll find them positive. But I think the church always wants to, and this is a continuous theme of Pope Benedict, is the desire to create a broader debate across society. The internet technologically can allow that, but it can only happen if we actually have a sense that there is a public space, that there is a public forum where we can, as people of faith and not faith, people of different philosophical traditions, find a language or a way of engagement that enables us to debate the big questions that face us as human beings. I think within the Catholic tradition, we're blessed that very often, particularly in the moral arena, we did our business in terms of natural law. So we fundamental intuition was that human beings, reflecting on what it is to be a human person in all its complexity and all its fullness, can begin to find a way of discerning what are the choices that help individuals to flourish and grow and that make society more healthy. And I think that's the methodology we want to get. Let's have people looking together, carefully examining ethical and moral arguments to try and work out, using the basic criteria of what it is to be human, to discern what are the right choices and what are the ones that help human beings to grow and to flourish.
You're talking about the need, in a sense, for two languages, for people to be almost bilingual, to speak a language of citizenship, of humanity, perhaps, that can reach people even if they don't share our views, and also the language of one specific tradition.
Yeah, I think this is the thing. I've been a student for a long time of the writings of Jonathan Sacks, the chief rabbi of Britain, and he's done two nice reflections that relate to each other. One, he's talking about religious language and broadcasting. And he said, the danger is sometimes, if I use the language I'm most comfortable and that has all the emotional appeal, I end up narrowcasting. I'm speaking only to the people who already agree with me. He says, broadcasting is more difficult because it's asking me to try and engage with people who don't share my suppositions. Therefore, the type of language I can use mightn't seem as rich as the language of our own particular faith tradition. He then developed that in a broader argument about moral argumentation in general. Was the type of arguments that I can use that will be very convincing to a fellow believer, because we share the same philosophical ideas, we share the same faith, we're coming out of the same tradition, but that won't engage somebody else. And yet, if I'm really interested in persuasion, in debate, in establishing a public arena, maybe at times it means using a language that doesn't seem quite as rich, but that is more effective in engaging people who don't share all my basic faith and philosophical presuppositions.
The real task, though, is how to bring these two languages closer together.
The reality is that I can't create almost like that I'm not at home in either world. I need to find a way that in which I can render the richness of my tradition in a language that is accessible to somebody who maybe doesn't share the same presuppositions.
We're looking also at the World Communications Day this month of May, focusing on the theme of the word and silence. Again, this theme of the need for time, for silence, for reflection, in a way seems to fly in the face of all that new media is really about.
Yeah, I think what the Pope's message this year has very fortunately touched into something that a lot of people are thinking about and reflecting about, not just people of faith. The Pope is saying that silence is important for communications, not that silence is a refusal of communications or even a refusal of the new technologies. What he's saying is, though, that good communication, good human communication, always required silence. I have to listen to the other person. In fact, my silence may be that which enables the other person to speak. Silence itself can be eloquent. One thinks of many times when the best thing you can do is be present and be silent rather than risking the wrong words. So I think that anthropological or human dimension of silence, the Pope has touched into something that other people are thinking about and reflecting about as well. The other thing about silence is, if I'm being bombarded with information and news and opinions and ideas, and I feel I have to engage immediately with that, the danger is I don't actually take the time to analyse, reflect, think about, and engage critically with all this material. And I think silence is a presupposition. If I'm going to be actually the one who is maybe, I don't want to say controlling, but the person who is directing my own communication rather than the person who's been forced into certain ideas and arenas without thinking it through. So in order to have a real quality of conversation rather than simply a quantity of conversation, we need to create that space and time for people to reflect critically, and silence is a presupposition for that. I think the other area that the Pope is very clearly opening up as a thing is that within the faith, within our Catholic faith tradition, but within also the faith traditions of other great world religions, the importance of silence and the importance of solitude, that I create space and time that allows me to hear the gentle voice of God among all the more shouting that I engage with in the public arena, that I need to create the space where I can listen to and hear that gentle word of God, which is necessary for us.
It's a difficult message to get across, isn't it? Particularly to the young generation who are more focused, less focused on solitude and more on friends and, as you say, this constant quality, quantity of communication.
I think there's two ways of seeing it. The desire of young people for constant communication and connectivity is itself saying that human nature has not changed. That fundamentally young people, no more than their parents before them, are searching for some sense of relationship. They want to feel that they're valued and they're cared for, and that they have the capacity to show their love and care for other people. What we, I think, want to do is invite them to see a richer idea of this, because there can be a vulnerability. I know many parents are talking to parents very often, that concern they have about sons and daughters who are constantly engaged, who are afraid somehow to switch off, who feel that if somehow they're not communicating, that they're not existing. And we want to deepen that and say, look, one of the ways in which we discover the truth of who we are is through our relationships with other people. But that also we need to be able to discover ourselves, learn who we are in the middle of that, and that that requires silence. So I think there's a countercultural element in what we're trying to say. But I think when people are in a safe environment, exposed to the possibility of silence and reflection and thinking, that that too will engage them.
My thanks there to Monsignor Paul Tai, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications.